Hey guys, welcome to episode 184 of the podcast with my guest, Ms. Savannah Sly. I'm not going to say too much about this because I just think the whole episode is replete with so much interesting stuff. I look forward to hearing from you guys about it, and I want to just jump into shout-outs. Ken, thanks for your great email. Ryan, thanks for yours. And Harry in Greece, thanks for yours. Josh, thanks for your email. You're a relatively new listener. I'm delighted to hear from you guys. I will need to catch up on shout-outs from other social media forums soon. I am, of course, up at Sketchfest, and it is a bit zany. I'm very excited about this weekend, Saturday the 16th. I'll be podcasting, as I have mentioned before in the intro, here up in San Francisco at noon at the Eureka Theater with Chuck Bryant from Stuff You Should Know podcast. And Josh Clark dropped out, but Veronica Belmont, awesome, dropped in, and musical guest Matt Nathanson. So this is shaping up to be quite a wonderful lineup. And any of you who are in the Bay Area, please come join us. Come join us. I think that's it, guys. So check it out. You know, when I say check it out, that's so vague. I could be talking about anything. Whatever it is that you're interested in, guys, check it out. And I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Don't you love living in the future?
I do love living in the future. I think that this is one of those things where this is only the second phone conversation / podcast recording I've done. And every other time I've been in the same room as someone. And so it still feels, even though this is the most common thing in the world with people doing radio, it's been around forever. Fortunately, we don't have to kind of work with the crackly phone sound of one person being remote and on a phone since we both get to record. Which I love, because there's always, for me, there's a little bit of like a checking out I do. It's not on purpose, but whenever I hear a phone conversation that is clearly like, yeah, I'm on the phone, I always sort of, there's some weird thing where like one tiny filter, it's not all of me, but one tiny filter like slips down into place. Does that make
sense?
Sure.
Yeah, that does make sense. I love living in what I call the future. I decided that we lived in the future when I first hopped on Skype. And I was talking to a friend in Estonia, and he's like, look at my bedroom. This is my cat. And I'm like, this is real time. And you're in Estonia. And like, and yeah, we're kind of doing something that's been done for many years via radio now, but we're doing it with like, you know, consumer technology. And it's on my laptop, which is this multi-purpose tool. And I'm using GarageBand, which came free with it. And I'm just going to Dropbox it to you, which is also free. And it's just so cool.
Agreed with all of that. And I think the key is saying, yeah, the idea of consumer technology, which also for me translates to like dilettante technology, because I've never pretended to have any real technological savvy. And the fact that I'm living in an era where that's not necessary and I can still not suck is fabulous.
You can not suck, and you can present yourself very well, actually, and you can articulate your thoughts and broadcast them to anywhere all over the world. You can market yourself. It's really kind of a new age, and I think that's very exciting for people who are creative and entrepreneurial.
You know what I love about the example that you gave too is that you gave Estonia as an example, which of course anybody who's familiar with it, and probably even people who aren't, it's such a great example of a place that is so rooted in the deep, deep past in terms of like, isn't Tallinn there? Is Tallinn Tallinn?
I don't know. I myself haven't been to Estonia. This is an American friend who moved over there to work with some performance artists.
It's funny. I think it's my friends who have been there because it's a quick I think it's like a quick ferry ride from, you know, Helsinki or some one of the Scandinavian countries, not to say Finland is, but it is supposedly one of the most culturally rich kind of, you know, one of those places like you hear about in Europe or in the Far East or, you know, Russia, where we as Americans don't have the experience of looking around and seeing 1,000-year-old architecture, you know? So
right.
I especially love the idea that you're reaching somebody who's, you know, in a place like that instead of just in, you know, New York City.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Great. And at the time, I was in a farmhouse in, you know, rural New England.
It was just
such a great experience to be so far away from each other and remote, you know, and able to connect so intimately and in real time. Yeah. So here we are, Janet.
Here we are, you and me, holding hands verbally as we dive into my podcast. The other thing I was going to say is funny because this just reminds me, and it might weirdly dovetail into some of the stuff I want to talk to you about, is I was just listening to a podcast, my own self, wherein someone was talking about how technology has made it so easy to be infidelitous in all kinds of new ways. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was interesting. I mean, of course, that's something that is said in one way or another frequently, but I don't know why it kind of stopped me in my tracks when I heard it put it kind of great and in an articulate way. It just kind of stopped me. I was like, God, I guess, yes, of course. I mean, we all talk about sort of sexting and how do we define the limits of fidelity, and every person's relationship gets to be different. And, you know, how do you sort of, what is your understanding with your partner, or what is your understanding with yourself? Like the way that we create our own personal boundaries in terms of everyone's varying level of a sense of honesty or a sense of loyalty. Mm-hmm. How has that kind of become even more nebulous potentially with, you know, this woman specifically was saying, you know, oh yeah, I was having this emotional affair with this guy. You know, I think we ended up having sex 3 times over 9 months. The rest of the time we were just texting all the time. And the interviewer said, did you text in front of your husband? And she said, oh yeah. Yeah, you know, it just didn't feel, I was so removed from, I was able to compartmentalize it so much that it sort of wasn't even something I was thinking about.
Right.
And I just thought that was really interesting.
It's really interesting. We really are in a new age in so many ways. The communication technology that we have is making us more able, obviously, to connect with so many different people than we ever have been able to before. And that's just rapidly changing everything. I mean, the places where I see it most as a member of like the kink and the BDSM and queer communities, it's really wonderful that people, whereas before they lived in complete isolation, thinking they were the one freak who was into X, Y, and
right.
Z. Now it's like you can find your community so easily and connect with those people. And I think that that's really wonderful. And I think that communication is wonderful for a huge multitude of reasons. But then there are, you know, we're at a crossroads in terms of what are our ethics around all this, and how does communication sort of exacerbate pre-existing human behavior, which is sort of like hurtful or harmful. And infidelity can certainly be one of those things. It really boils down to being honest and open with your partner and whether you're able to do that or not. As a sex worker, I help people navigate that with some frequency, and I certainly work with a lot of people who are seeing me unbeknownst to their partner. And mm-hmm. I would say that that's something that a lot of sex workers sort of tangle with as a hard part of our job, because, you know, it's kind of hard to feel good about that. But there's so many different reasons why people see us. And at the end of the day, it's sort of like, sometimes I feel like, very often I feel like a therapist or a psychologist who's helping somebody navigate something privately. And I think a lot of people see therapists unbeknownst to their partners or other people because they need a safe place to process something. And sometimes I feel like a bartender, you know, where it's like, you know, like, you're not supposed to be here, buddy. Well, you know, am I going to not serve you, you know, like only if I think that you are causing harm to yourself or others, you know? So it's,
you know, let me stop you just for a second, Savannah, because for anybody who for some reason didn't bother to read the description because it just they subscribe to the podcast and it automatically downloads right into their ears. would you mind quickly sort of introducing yourself and just talk briefly about kind of what it is that you do and what you're all about?
Sure.
And I say that, what you're all about, and
what
take
I'm
30
all
seconds.
About. Yeah. Let me tell you all about myself. Hey, listeners. My name is Savannah Sly, or Ms. Savannah, as I'm known in some realms. And I am among many other things, I am a career sex worker. And I'm a sex worker rights activist and advocate. I'm currently the president of the Sex Workers Outreach Project, which is a national nonprofit with dozens of local chapters around the country that's dedicated to reducing harm and stigma and violence experienced by sex workers due to stigma and discrimination. All that is directed at sex workers and also their communities. And we also address some of the intersectional issues related to all of that. That's kind of my full-time, unpaid volunteer gig that I spend a whole lot of time doing. And one reason I'm able to do that is because I am a sex worker, and I have been for January is this is my 12 or 13 year anniversary, I think, as a sex worker. Yeah. I got started when I was a week after my 19th birthday. And when I say sex worker, for those of you who don't know what that phrase means, the phrase sex worker is used to describe anybody who is working within what we call, there's a variety of phrases, the sex trade, the sex industry, the adult industry, the erotic industry. Sometimes sex workers don't refer to themselves as sex workers. They might refer to themselves as erotic services providers. And then within that, under that umbrella, there's so many different kinds of people. There's erotic dancers and strippers, webcam models, escorts, massage parlor providers, porn stars, phone sex operators, sugar babies. I mean, I'm pretty generous with who I put under that umbrella. The criteria for me is this something that you can't tell everybody about? Is this something you could never put on a resume? Is this something that could cause you to lose custody of your kids? Or that somebody could discriminate against you before? But that said, not everybody classifies themselves as a sex worker, either because their job might not involve sex. And so they might think that sex worker means that it must involve sex, which that's not usually how the phrase is used. But also, a lot of people, this is sort of being a sex worker is sort of a form of being closeted in some ways. And that's not to to try and take power from the gay rights movement, who has used the idea of closeting to really explain their situation. But when you're a sex worker, you can be extremely isolated. If you don't have community or somebody understanding around you, it's possible that you are operating in complete secrecy. And there's a lot of downsides that can come along with that. So, I'm a sex worker, and that's my deal. Ta-da!
Thank you so much, and thanks for listening. Goodbye, everybody. No, I really appreciate you taking the time out, and I think that's everything that you're saying really resonates with me, because a lot of the stuff that you're talking about attaches to my own experience as a non-sex worker, but as somebody who has had many friends working in that community, some of whom were more out about it than others. You know, obviously living in San Francisco, sometimes can be luxuries, if you will call them that, to being in a much more liberal society and environment, and where there are pockets of places where that's something that's applauded, or it gets shouted out a lot.
Frankly,
when you look at some of the
San Francisco has been historically a beacon for decades of the sex worker rights movement. California's where SWAP got started in 2003, and there's just so much that San Francisco has done to further the issue of sex workers' rights, as well as many other liberal issues. So yeah, I bet you did have a good handful of friends who were in this industry.
Well, it's a wonderful bubble, right? I mean, for me, and not to make this all about me, as I usually do on a podcast, but for me, when I kind of think about, and I've talked about my experience with, like, my sort of experiences with being exposed to sex outside of my own personal experience with it as a young person, it really was limited to sort of, okay, here are these Playboys that I just found that I wasn't supposed to find. Here is this hardcore porn that my friends and I found at their parents' house that we weren't supposed to find. And then, moving to San Francisco at 19 and suddenly, and also, sort of adult bookstores being this kind of place where, you have this, I'm from Tucson, you have this sort of seedy underbelly side of things where, it feels like it's just for, male sex offenders in their 40s. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then coming to San Francisco, and very quickly after coming to San Francisco, finding out about Good Vibrations and this very sex positive movement in San Francisco, and feeling like, you know, and going to the Lusty Lady as this female owned unionized strip club.
Yeah.
And thinking, hold on, now hold on a second. This doesn't feel like...
This is different.
An environment of broken women who don't have a handle on their sexuality, or do feel that, you know, or are living as victims in a patriarchal society, excuse me. And how does that kind of align with my own worries about... And I certainly don't mean to lean that hard into women in the sex trade, but I do, because I am one, and my own relationship with how I view pornography has sort of gone through a million different iterations and complicated feelings that I have about it. So that's kind of what I, you know, that's the perspective that I look at it from. And so when I get into conversations with people, you know, as you well know much better than I, there are so many different perspectives, even within a feminist community, or, you know, a feminist viewpoint, it just gets hard, because if it's something that's so fraught, I love that you're doing something to unite people, or to create a place where people can talk about it, because it gets so fraught that, you know, two women who consider themselves feminists could be locking horns till the day they die about the sex trade.
And about other things, such as the rights of a transgender person to call themselves a woman. You know, there's different branches. Feminism has been around for long enough that there's several different kinds, you know. So, not all feminists agree that sex work is a viable means of employment. Some feminists feel that sex work is inherently harmful. That does sort of fly in the face of sex workers who do come forward to express their truth, saying this isn't harmful for me, I choose this, for whatever variety of reasons. I love that, I mean
I think that's a very powerful response from a feminist pro sex trade, to say, please don't tell me, if you're a feminist, you don't get to tell me that I'm wrong and that
what
I'm a
victim. Do and don't do with
that's
my body,
that's the opposite. Yeah. exactly
yeah.
Let me ask you this. What was your relationship? I mean, I kind of just quickly said, you know, this is what my exposure was as a younger person, and kind of how it blossomed open for me, if you will, when I came to San Francisco. Since we talk about teen years on the podcast a bit, what was your experience as a teenager? I'm certainly interested to kind of know who you were far away beyond this particular piece, but it might be a good way in to kind of find out more about you as a young person as well. Did you have a similar experience to what I did with kind of finding out about sex outside of my circle of friends or myself?
I think I've always been keenly interested in finding out about sex from a pretty young age. I remember being 7 and 8, and there would be a flash of something sexy on TV, like an advertisement, or I'd see just a peek of like kind of a racy comic book that my cousin had, and I'd be like, what's that? Give that to me, you know? And and I couldn't, just because I was like really like fascinated, and I was probably kind of turned on, but at that age I didn't really know what that was, you know, but I just knew that I'm like, I don't know what that is, but I would love to see more of that. And and so I would kind of like sneak little glimpses into the adult world wherever I could, never really got very far.
Do you mind if I ask where you grew up, or the sort of general area?
Yeah, I grew up in rural Vermont.
Okay.
So, but I also grew up in Maryland. So I grew up in Maryland until I was about 8, and then I moved to rural Vermont.
Okay.
But either way, I mean, I had a lovely childhood, middle class family, really supportive, awesome parents, great siblings, and I had some friends. And I'm so lucky to say that I didn't really have any misfortune really come my way as a child. Until I was in middle school, there was definitely an inciting incident that I think really formed a lot of my political beliefs that helped propel me today. But we can get to that in a second. As far as sex goes, I mean, I lost my virginity when I was 16. I certainly was trying to lose it a bit earlier than that. I just didn't really have any game. I was a pretty nerdy kid. I had like a robust crop of pimples at all times all over my body. Yes. I was picked on. I was geeky. I wanted to be goth so badly, but it's hard to be goth in Vermont, especially when you don't have TV. And I remember seeing like a Trent Reznor video once when I was in seventh grade and being like, where do you get leather pants? I don't sure. know where you get these things. And it's like, yeah. I had the internet, you know, I was on Yacht. I had an internet boyfriend. So I would exercise. Actually, before I lost my virginity, I had a really hot internet relationship for 2 years with a boy that I never met. But it was a totally kinky relationship. And we would be up on the phone all night. And yeah, so I was definitely interested in sexuality and wanting to try it out. And then once I lost my virginity, I kind of experimented sexually with different people in high school. And yeah, I didn't really realize I was kinky for a while. Didn't realize that I'm a fantasizer and kind of a role player, which is definitely, I consider that to be kind of like my orientation, you know? So, but sex was it was satisfying in terms of like connecting with someone and feeling desired and providing pleasure. That's always been immensely gratifying for me. But otherwise, sex felt pretty kind of like investigative or academic. And it's like I would sleep with people sometimes, not because I really loved them or was really attracted to them. I mean, I would be a little attracted to them, but mostly to be like, I wonder how you fuck. You know, like this will be interesting.
Oh, interesting.
You know, like, and in early. I went to art school in Boston, and during the first year or two of that, I remember I kind of developed this like pitch I would give people being like, I think you're super cool. I would love to move forward with this. Hey, this might be the only time we do this because I'm kind of not into commitment right now, but I would love to experiment with you this one time. Are you okay with that? And then they got to make the decision as to whether they were okay with that. Some were, some weren't. Some thought they were, and then later they weren't, and that was hard, and I had to kind of learn how to navigate that. But yeah, so I've always been interested in sexuality, and actually, it took me, I think I'm still learning about my sexuality. I think there's something about me as somebody who's sexually curious about other people. I've always been fascinated in what makes other people tick. Yeah, like, how do you fuck, and like, what are your kinks and fetishes, and what's your orgasm face, and how can I figure out how to push all your buttons, and that's always been like kind of a delight to me and a challenge. And I think that that's something that makes me a really great provider of so many different kinds of fantasies. I specialize as a dominatrix. I've worked just about every kind of job that you could imagine in the sex industry. But I specialize in fantasy and fetish. And so in that regard, I've gotten to help hundreds, maybe thousands of people explore their fetishes and fantasies. But when it comes to me, I feel like I'm still growing, and I hope to always grow and discover new parts of myself. So,
yeah. Yeah. And so when you were talking earlier about the idea of this kind of therapy and the idea of people's infidelities.
Hold on.
Oh, sure, sure.
I'm choking on my tea.
I definitely want you to be able to breathe. You know, what I've come across in some of my friendships with people who had their various different relationships to their sexuality. You know, I had friends who felt, I think, very investigative and curious in the way that you described, and that played out all the way across through having those sexual experiences with people. And then I had, you know, I can think of one friend I had who had all of those proclivities, but in the end, what my observation was and what, you know, she would share with me, sometimes kind of unknowingly not realizing that she was having these complicated emotions, would be that she would go into something, as you kind of talked about with someone on the opposite end of experiences you had, where she would go into something as very sex positive, very sort of, I don't have an emotional attachment to this person that I've just met tonight and that I'm going home with. And then unfortunately, you know, I'm not sure where that yearning for more intimacy on an emotional level or just doing it again with that person, I don't know where that was born. And I think people's assumptions, you know, are, oh, that's like once you, you know, as a woman, once you've been penetrated, suddenly you want to have this man's baby. And I'm speaking, you know, in broad generalizations about straight, you know, straight tropes. But,
right.
But in fact, she would come back and say, you know, why hasn't he called? And so that was always, that was confusing for me. And again, I've had friends who don't have that relationship to it at all. But I always, because I had difficulty teasing those things apart, and it is what it is, you know, at this point and the age I am, I'm totally fine with that. But there was a period of time when I envied that sexual adventurousness, and I wanted to have it more, and I wanted to have it without emotional strings attached. And it was almost frustrating to me as like a 21-year-old that I couldn't kind of see my way around or through that. Does that make sense?
Totally. And I run into people all the time who have varying levels of emotional need in order to have a sexual connection with somebody. And I think that this illustrates the point that we all have different needs at different times in our lives, and we have different connections with each and every person that we open up to or meet with. So what this makes me think of is like, well, first of all, it's like I have had those experiences too, where I'm like, oh, this will be fun, you know, and I'll hook up with somebody and be like, oh, they're really great. Yeah, that was really great.
Yeah.
I wonder, will I be coming on too strong if I like, you know, show that I like them? And sometimes there's room for that, and sometimes there's not. And that's okay if everybody knows what the intentions are before going into something.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question too, because if you're that's a good question that I would love to ask you, which is that now that you're in a position where those ground rules are very laid out in a probably pretty concise way, because what it comes down to is, you know, bottom line, so if someone's paying you for those services, does it still get complicated? Do you have people who say, you know, I thought I just wanted this, but now I have these feelings and I don't know what to do with them because I know that you're a sex worker and I'm not the only person that you share this with?
Right. Well, it's less complicated for me because I'm approaching it in a totally different mindset. You know, like I might have done this four times that day already. You know, it's my job, and I'm a provider. I am very much there 100% for this person. I'm not there to get my own gratification out of this. And I've actually found that, I mean, occasionally I do enjoy what I do. You know, it's like it can be sexy sometimes, and I can enjoy things, but as soon as I start angling any of what we're doing towards my enjoyment, I find that the client experience goes down tremendously. And you know, people pay a fair chunk of money to see me for an hour or two, and I feel that for that rate, it should be a 100% them experience. I'm really taking them on a very highly customized ride through their nerve endings and their brain. And I have my own play partners in my own life, and that's where I get my fulfillment, you know? So I might occasionally derive like secondhand enjoyment from something, like a sensation or an idea, or ooh, that does look pretty sexy, you know? But I really need to maintain 100% focused on my client, and I think that that's why I have a really loyal clientele. Now, I have definitely had a great many clients. I wouldn't say that they're the majority, but maybe like, you know, 10%. Who have met me. And I think that a lot of people are sometimes surprised when they meet me because I do market myself as a dominatrix. One of my favorite things to do at the very beginning of a session is I take somebody's pulse just to like see if their heart is completely pounding out of their chest.
Sure,
they might be
that
cool
makes
as a cucumber.
Like, never thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it depends. Like, I read a person when they walk in the door, and if they look terrified, you know, like if they want to be terrified, I just milk that and I just drag them right into the session, and, you know, they have a terrifying experience. And then afterwards, I'm like, well, that was fun, wasn't it? But sometimes people, they're really going out on a limb. This might be the first time that they've shared their kink with somebody. They might be totally insecure about what they want to do, but they are like, they're going to trust me because I have a good reputation to provide a safe, non-judgmental space for them. And so I think sometimes people are surprised when I'm not all like domly dom with them, and I'm like, hey, how are you doing? Have a seat. Would you like a cup of tea? Let's talk a little bit before we get started.
Sure.
And I think that, I would say the majority of sex workers that I know have a pretty nurturing side to them.
Well,
it's not like
it
that
like
mother
it, it
nurturing.
Sounds like if you're able to do this and you're really providing that service in sort of a holistic way, it is very interesting, because it seems like, how could you do that without a tremendous sense of empathy and without a sort of a tenderness for humankind, do you know?
Sure,
instead of a contempt for it, do you know?
Right. And again, there are so many different kinds of sex work. And it's like there are also plenty of sex workers who want very little of that. Like, so like an erotic dancer or a webcam model, somebody might gravitate to that line of work because maybe there's less contact. Sure. Maybe they don't need to talk to you as much. And maybe they don't need to do that. Maybe they're not there for the emotional labor. And they're like, you can just like look at my hot body and we'll get you off and please pay me.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
And they might enjoy that, or they might just be earning their bread and butter. But there's also a ton of providers out there who do provide a great deal of healing and safe space and are nurturing and sexy. And there's also, you know, just to speak, there's such a huge variety of people in this work. And I do want to address the complexities of sex work because a lot of people are really concerned about it. They think that it's inherently violent and it's not. You know, like I'm definitely an empowered sex worker. This has been a wonderful thing for me. It's given me total freedom in so many ways. It helped me get over like an eating disorder and all this stuff. And I feel like a very confident person because of it. But then there's people on the other side of the spectrum who really might only be doing this because it is their only means of making money, you know, right. Like, so maybe they're discriminated against and can't get a job because of their gender or sexuality, you know, or, you know, maybe there's just very few other options open to them. And then there's everybody in between, you know, and then sex trafficking is a really hot topic that's talked about a lot in our world these days. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly instances where the sex industry can be a tremendously abusive and violent place.
Right.
I don't, like, as a 12-year career sex worker who has, like, studied this in depth and knows, has met, like, thousands of other sex workers, and really, I have my ear to the ground, I don't think that the issue of sex trafficking is nearly to the scope or magnitude that it is purported to be in popular media.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's a bit of a hysteria, and I would be happy to talk about that more if there's any interest. If it's too heavy, we can talk about other stuff.
No, but, well, first of all, I know that my normal amount of time for the podcast is never going to feel like enough, neither to me nor anybody listening. These are the things that I've put a pin in my head. I do want to hear a little bit more about the incident that you had in middle school. We don't have to jump into that yet. But,
sure.
But you actually just answered one of the other two pins that I had sitting in my brain, which were to ask you, yeah, kind of what you see outside, what kind of behavior, point of view, rhetoric do you see outside of the sex worker community that frustrates you? And then what kind of stuff do you see inside of it that frustrates you as an activist?
So on the outside, that what frustrates me is I see a lot of assumptions and misunderstanding, moral judgment and fear,
mm-hmm.
which is dictating what happens to the sex industry and what happens to sex workers and all people involved in it, you know, and not just sex workers, but clients and our communities and families.
Yeah.
I feel like looking at the sex industry is kind of like looking at sex in terms of how people divide it in binary ways in their mind. So it's like sex is either like, hooray, sex is awesome and empowering and you love your partner and you connect and you're a liberated woman and you can learn how to get off and buy this vibrator, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, and then there's the other side of things, which is like sex can be extremely traumatic and we have a huge problem with rape and we sexualize women as these objects we use in like football commercials and, there's male privilege and we really need to get a grip on sex because it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a whole lot in between. We need to protect kids from sex. Kids can't see, we can't even teach them how to use condoms because they'll have sex, you know,
right.
Like, oh, hey, let's hand out a bunch of free condoms at our pride parade. You know, it's like, there's not much in between.
Right.
And like that, the sex industry suffers from the same binary thinking, which, you have like, you know, empowered sex workers on one side who are like, you know, I can make money for myself. I'm my own boss. This has helped me learn how to really negotiate my own personal boundaries. I feel beautiful. I feel sexy and I help people. And then there's the other side, which the public hears a lot, which is like, you know, this girl has been abused sexually throughout her whole childhood. She was forced into this when she was a teenager.
Right.
She continues this pattern of rape on a daily basis
mm-hmm.
as a prostituted person.
Right.
And we don't look at anything in the middle when the majority of stuff exists in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, a person, you know, it's like I have plenty. It's, you know, and you know, it's like both things are true. Both things exist in sex and the sex industry, but it's our inability to acknowledge everything in the middle and to think of different combinations, you know, to think of all the vast variety of experiences that people have around sexuality and with work and with just trying to like get through this world, you know. Sure. Those binaries don't address that. So when you create policies that dictate how people are going to use their bodies and make a living and survive based upon fear, you know, you are... Well, especially when you're criminalizing people, mm-hmm. then you're really hindering people's ability to survive. You're putting a bunch of people in the closet. You're creating a black market. And I mean, I guess this could segue into like a slightly different topic. So one of the biggest frustrations I see is trying to eradicate prostitution is kind of like the war on drugs. It's a lot like the war on drugs, right. And we're treating it like the war on right. drugs. And actually, there's a lot of legislative initiatives going on around this country that very much mimic how we handled the war on drugs. And all the propaganda is very similar. The reasons for doing it are very similar. And it's going to have, and it is having, the same effect. And this is very close to me, that inciting incident in middle school that I talked about. Mm-hmm. When I was in eighth grade, the FBI raided my house.
Oh, wow.
And took all of our stuff. And long story short, it turns out that one of my parents had been involved in selling marijuana in a southern state for a long time and a pretty large quantity of it with some of their friends. And that is where a lot of our middle class income came from, mm-hmm. you know. And my parents are wonderful people. They're artists. They're nonviolent. This was a first time offense mm-hmm. For that individual. And long story short, that I got to experience firsthand how when you deem somebody a criminal for making a living, you're not only changing that person's life, but everybody connected to them
yeah.
in a really negative way. So all of a sudden I had a single parent. I had one parent. Mm. I had one parent in jail. Ugh. And didn't really feel like I could talk to my friends much about that. I told one or two of them, but it was just sort of like all of a sudden there's the stigma of like, oh, your parents are bad. You know, you're sure. bad people. You're drug sure. dealers. And I didn't, you know, and we didn't want to be thought of that way. But then I had one parent who had worked like three or four jobs at a time, totally stressed out. And it was just traumatic, you know, like we had a raid on our house.
Ugh,
and sex workers get raided all the time.
Yeah.
Sex workers get raided all the time. And the war on drugs was kind of in the name of saving the children. You know, like if you remember the DARE program,
sure, sure.
it was an abstinence thing. It was total prohibition. We're going to eradicate drug use. And then we've got all this shit in Mexico, and it's just like such a disaster.
Yeah. Well, no, I think you're. I really respond to what you're saying because I think that is, again, we sort of get into these like the way the kind of macrocosmic way when you get into politics, when you get into money, when you get into relationships between opposing countries, when you get into relationships between states, when all of that huge stuff, not to say that all of life isn't this, but that using something like the sex trade or using something like the drug war, those kinds of things as really intimate, very complicated examples of that. When you're talking something as huge as the relationship that the U.S. has to Mexico or to, you know, Cuba or to, you know, any other country, and that same conversation also includes whether a kid is going to take a joint from his buddy, that is so fraught. I mean, that is so complicated because mm-hmm. you're talking mm-hmm. about 1,000 different levels of stuff and that everything gets convoluted together. And so the question is no longer, is it harmless to smoke a little pot, and becomes, yeah, but what about our trade agreement with Guatemala? Do you know what I mean? And that's like,
right.
oh shit, we're really talking about many different things and rolling it all up into one thing.
We are, and that's what I'm seeing with, I call it the war on whores, and I'm not the only one who calls it that,
mm-hmm.
but the sex trafficking hysteria really is, to me, the new war on drugs, and I think it's really interesting that as the war on drugs has become passé, and we have finally owned up to the fact on, like, all levels of society that that was a huge failure, mm-hmm. That we're seeing this ramp up in like millions and millions of dollars distributed across the country to enforce the police to stop trafficking. We're seeing increase in different kinds of surveillance techniques and a decrease in privacy rights kind of left and right across the board to help monitor for sex trafficking. It's an immigration issue in many ways. It's a morality issue. It's a save the children issue. And it's totally fueled by fear. And when I say these things, I'm kind of hearing myself talk, and I feel like it's really easy to come off as insensitive when I'm speaking this way, because it is true that sex trafficking is a thing, you know, like I call it rape, you know, yeah. Like I call it coercion.
Yeah.
And there are instances, it's like, it's just, it gets down to these stereotypes, you know? So the stereotype of human trafficking in America is that there's a pimp who has a bunch of girls and women that he drives around the country or has in a city, and he forces them to sleep with up to 10, 20, 40 men a day, depending on what you're reading.
Right.
In these stereotypes, the pimp is usually a man of color, right. You know, and all the women are typically young white girls. You know, there's a weird thing that happens. If you kind of like Google sex trafficking and you look at the images that come up, you see a lot of racial stereotypes that come up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, profiling is a huge problem with this. There's lots of different measures popping up around the country where profiling is okay. You know, this person looks like a prostitute. We're going to stick our nose into their business.
Sure,
you know,
sure,
like,
sure. Yeah, that's anyways. That's, and because that when you get into race and class, and that was the other thing I was going to throw out at you, which is do you feel that there's an association between like socioeconomic indicators in terms of who does what, and are there expectations and stereotypes that aren't true about who has a pimp, who is a hooker in this way, versus who had an education and lives in San Francisco and has
right.
a cooperative? Are there things that are coming into play because of people's backgrounds or because of the communities that they grew up in, and does that end up coming into play? Or can a black woman who came from absolute abject poverty somewhere in the country end up being a great sex educator, sex worker, and sex advocate who was able to become educated, if not in the system, mm-hmm. then outside of the system? And do people, is mm-hmm. there room for people to believe that's possible? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, that brings up a lot of things. The first thing that is just vividly on the forefront of my mind is a very recent issue that illustrates power dynamics and how race and class are really fucked up when we're talking about criminalization and stigma around the sex trade and around drug use and other things.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this case, the sentencing for this guy is happening on January 21st. His name is Daniel Holklotz. Have you heard about this case?
I think this name is sounding so familiar and I'm blanking.
So this douchebag is a former police officer who has raped and sexually assaulted and stalked up to 13 women who have maybe more, but 13 women who have come forward and testified against him in court. They are all African-American black women, and they're all from the similar or same neighborhood, generally low income. A lot of these women have records as drug users or prostitutes.
Yeah.
And this guy was using the power and intimidation of his badge to completely assault and terrorize these women, knowing that they wouldn't come forward because of their, like, essentially their social status. Like, who's going to believe this drug addict, you know? And some of them did. They had, I'm learning that there were complaints filed against this guy, you know? And I read an interesting article recently about, like, it wasn't until, like, he messed with the wrong woman. And there was one in particular woman who he pulled over and raped. And she filed a complaint. And that finally got the ball rolling towards some justice. But this is like, you know, I mean, sex work's an intersectional issue, you know. It's intersectional to trans rights, to the Black Lives Matter movement. It's to immigration rights and things like that, to drug use. There's so many things that are connected to this that have to do with social justice and power. And I think that this Holzklotz case is an example of how all those things, like, so if drug use and prostitution weren't criminalized but decriminalized, right, these women wouldn't have a criminal record. They would have had that much more leverage to speak up,
right,
about this and have people believe them, you know? Right. So that's the first thing that came up, but we can dive deeper into this issue.
God, it's so hard. There's so much, and I'm so interested in... I do love the kind of origin story of everyone that I talk to sort of see how things, you know, take right turns and left turns, and or maybe they just seem like a straight line from this really developmental process that we go through as adolescents, where, you know, everything gets cranked up to 11. I can't believe I'm still making Spinal Tap references. Everything gets cranked
who
up.
Who isn't?
I mean,
who
it's just very concise.
That?
It's very concise and very easy and reminds you of something funny. But that we still are... we're developing so quickly and so fiercely, and so much of our hormonal, you know, our sort of sexuality and our intelligence, those things become enmeshed at the same time. People, you know, joke about how it becomes impossible to think because your hormones are raging, and, you know, those places and times where we find out why, well, maybe we don't ever find out why, but we sort of start getting these hints as to what is sexually exciting for us. And, you know, this, I think that, again, there's this sort of idea that someone who has this, and I'm using, you know, a conservative's words, aberrant, quote unquote, sexual interest or proclivity, that has to be immediately tied into trauma. I'm always interested in that as well, because obviously you can go to the very farthest end of that spectrum and say, well, what was a child molester's childhood like, you know, and make that the example. Or you can go to a CEO who loves to be dominated and say, oh, well, does that have something to do with the fact that, you know, it's something more simple and somehow more benign, mm-hmm, to everyone, this idea that's easier to wrap around in this patriarchal society of, well, I understand that men are used to being in charge, so they like having, if they're straight, they like having a woman be in charge with sex, which is not, I'm not saying that's not true or that there aren't, you know, millions of men who feel that way, and that's totally fine. But again, it goes into that sort of, if it's something we feel fearful of, how do we apply the simplest examples we can, rather than, you know what, this guy loves to be pissed on, and guess what? He doesn't know why, and it's not because he has too much power or not enough power or this or that, or there's this one thing that caused that or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, I mean, another thing that pops to mind is, you know, trying to understand what motivates rape, you know, and it's my understanding, and people who talk about rape and where that comes from, it's like this guy, Daniel Holzklotz, this wasn't about sex, I don't think. I don't think this was his sex drive. I think this was about power, violence, and intimidation. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how else he... I wonder how he treated other members of the community. I wonder how he treated black men from the same community, if he was just like a super asshole cop or what.
Right.
You know, like, this is power tripping, and it's about making people small and exerting your authority in a really fucked up way.
Yeah.
So... And I, you know, I'm part of the BDSM community, and, you know, the BDSM community, it's like they do some extreme heavy stuff that to the outside eye, somebody who wasn't like in on what was going on, might look really scary or really violent, you know, like, but it's like consent is key, you know, and also, you know, people in the BDSM community play with different heavy ideas in different ways for different reasons. Sometimes it's for sex, you know, sometimes it's for a turn on. Sometimes it's to have a cathartic release around an experience. Sometimes it's to challenge yourself. Sometimes it's about trusting your partner. There's a lot of different reasons that people engage in that kind of consensual activity. Mm-hmm. But that is, in my opinion, completely removed to the kind of non-consensual heinous crimes that we see in this kind of case.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I would love to get a sense of from you is, do you feel that there's a perception among even open-minded but non-sex workers or people that are more adjacent to that world, that is your entire existence and being, like that you don't like anything else, that you only, you know what I mean, that your life rotates around that one thing, and that you, that someone doesn't imagine you, you know, loving to go watch Downton Abbey, or do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that happens to a lot of people in different professions, you know, like, I don't know, it's like I was dating a chef once for a while and I actually brought him home for Christmas and my mom got him a cookbook, you know, right. Like, it's right. Like, oh, don't you like cooking? Uh-huh. You know, like, isn't that your job? And it's like, well, actually, that's my job.
Right.
You know, like, right, right. And I actually, you know, I relate sex work to cooking a lot, actually, because it's like, there's just a lot of parallels in terms of like, sometimes people just want a nice meal made for them, you know, and they don't want to fuss about it in the kitchen. And if somebody is willing to like put in the time and get paid to make that nice meal and, you know, cooking for people can be a really intimate thing, you know, mm-hmm. or it can be a not intimate thing. It can totally just be like, I'm just totally removed from this and I'm making some noodles for somebody, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes a chef wants somebody else to make them, you know, a meal. And sometimes a chef isn't really into the cuisine that they cook for work. You know, sometimes a chef, their favorite meal might just be a bowl of cereal, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. It's like, I don't personally feel like I've been, pegged into being the sex person. I mean, granted, I am fascinated by this.
Yeah.
That's why this is like my full-time activist thing, mm-hmm. you know, right now. But yeah, we all have, you know, like anybody else, like the vast majority of us all have hobbies and families and community and things we think about. And this is our job. And even if we're like a lot of sex workers I know are also sex educators and they might be a member of like the sex positive community. And that might take up a lot of their world, you know, like, but they have other interests too.
Do you think that's something that, because I'm thinking about, there's kind of a neat podcast. Oh my God. Again, I'm from the 1950s. Listen, Daddy-O, there's a neato podcast out there. there's a podcast called, Death, Sex, and Money. That's mm-hmm, a WNYC.
I've listened to it.
Yeah. And I, you know what? I think Anna Sales actually interviewed a sex worker who said, this is a job I don't like. And I feel very uncomfortable not wanting to speak on behalf of other sex workers who do not have that experience with it. And it becomes difficult if you are pushed out into the spotlight with your point of view, because that if people have a curiosity and a fear about something, and again, what we talked about before, which is sort of putting a label on everything, then it becomes, oh, okay, I have this one person I heard about, so now I know all sex workers are miserable.
Right, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah,
and
she was
really
very careful.
I really respected how they handled that.
Mm-hmm. I like
that,
too.
She was super careful,
but I thought, well,
and she was respectful of all, you know,
yeah.
all experiences, and then she articulated hers so beautifully and so honestly.
I really,
and I'm glad that
yeah, I love
they were
that.
Able to protect her identity that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, guys, so. I would say if you are interested in this, and I also want to make sure, certainly before we stop podcasting, that I get from you other places that people can read up and places they can hear from you. And because I just know I'm going to get a flood of letters from people saying, why didn't you ask this? Why didn't you ask this? Why wasn't it a 4-hour podcast? I'm frustrated.
Why didn't you ask
which
that?
Which I
why didn't you
will
ask
feel
that?
Myself. I mean, if I go back and listen to this, I'm going to be like, oh, Varney, God, you were all over the place. And there are like 80 things you didn't touch on. But I wanted to, but the reason I brought that up is because I think that I love everything that you just said about this, you know, a chef as a great example, as could be, you know, any other vocation. And she kind of had to do the same thing. Is that one of the most common experiences that you have or is the most common kind of simple idea that you feel responsible for kind of implanting in people's mind, which is as much as you person who doesn't want to be a sex worker might not be able to make that parallel because your feelings about sex are tied to something beyond a chef's, what your perception of a chef's relationship to food is, you have to accept that this is a job. And that while it may not be true for every sex worker, and you can't be expected to speak for every sex worker, that people really need to be able to see it as a vocation, and that's the only thing that's going to change policy about it as well. I just asked you. I just
well,
basically said
to,
it was like a paragraph, and then at the end I was like, "Is that true?"
Right. So I'm trying. I did listen to that podcast and I'm trying to remember all the details of it. And what I came away with is that this person doesn't like being a sex worker. They don't like the actual interaction. It makes them feel weird, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I would also like to talk about how, like, sex work is not right for everybody for so many reasons, right, you know? Right. Like, just like there are certain jobs that are not good for me. I've had certain like office jobs that were really detrimental to me in many ways that are kind of hard to articulate. And that might sound like kind of like a cop off to be like, oh, well, office work is nothing like being sexual with somebody. But for me, being sexual with somebody is way easier than sitting at a desk every day from 9 to 5.
I think that makes sense. I think that makes sense. And side note, you know, I've had relationships at work that were far more complicated than whatever sex relationship I was having in my private life, which is to say, having a boss who's responsible for your paycheck, who also has passive aggressive tendencies, or who is bipolar, or who, et cetera, et cetera. And when you do feel trapped in any job, that mm-hmm. is incredibly yeah. complicated, and it absolutely can spill into every aspect of your life, no matter totally. What that job is.
And be demoralizing. If you feel like you're trapped in any situation, that means that your power is diminished. And when you don't have your power, you're vulnerable. And so I remember with this this person who was speaking on that podcast, I forget exactly why they were stuck there. But something that comes to mind is a lot of people feel like they get stuck in the sex industry because of things like resume gaps. You know, like I personally, as Savannah Sly, like for me to fill out like a straight vanilla everyday job application and having to hide all of that, it would be like, what the fuck have you been doing for 8 years? Right. You know, like right. it's like, oh, you know,
I was princess
I was in Thailand
in
exploring. Yeah, I was in a castle twiddling my thumbs.
Right.
So that's just one basic thing that is a huge barrier. So right now, another pressing news item that I've been responding to all week with my community is in Seattle, where I've spent a great deal of time. Love that city. A community discussion and advertising board called the Review Board just got seized and shut down by the police in Seattle. And I know a ton of people on that site. And Swap Seattle, one of our local chapters, did a wonderful job of responding and putting the sex worker rights slant on this story. This is a story of human trafficking. But you know, there were a lot of screenshots of this website were released in the DA's press kit and in the news. And a lot of my friends, all of a sudden, there's their stage name in big letters on TV being broadcast, sometimes nationally, you know, like there's their name. And, you know, this is their brand that they've spent years building up and they can't use that name anymore. They feel totally insecure. A bunch of people have been panicking. It causes so much fear in people. And then, so I talked to at least one friend just the other day who's like, yep, I have an interview hopefully next week, you know, like not sure how I'm going to explain my resume gap, you know? But it's like, that might sound like a small thing, but it's a huge thing, you know? Especially when you're facing like an outing situation like that. And she's just kind of looking for whatever gig will tide her over, because it's not that she doesn't feel comfortable working, but she doesn't feel safe working because she thinks she's going to get arrested, you know? Yeah. And that means that she would get outed. And, you know, and getting outed is another big deal. It's like you could get evicted, lose custody of your kids, lose your vanilla job if you do have one. Mm-hmm. You could get rejected by your family. Mm-hmm. And then you have a record as a prostitute forever on the internet. And it's like, and in some places you might be on the sex offender registry. It really varies from state to state. And so, the criminalization of sex work really causes so much, kind of like a lot of the things that you get with a black market, getting back to the war on drugs, you know, it's like, you know, is it safer to go and try and score weed in a city that you're visiting where you don't know anybody? Or could you just go to like the pot store and like pick some up?
Right.
Yeah, what's safer, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Let me ask you this. If you listen to a recent episode, you know that I play a MASH game at the end, which I am absolutely bound and determined to do with you.
Because
I think it'll be a really fun window into some of those things that I said, you know, are you just this person? Now, I used up a ton of time on the podcast talking about that stuff because I feel so lucky to have been connected with you. And I feel so grateful and appreciative for you to bring your, you know, immeasurable kind of wisdom and experience in something that, as I'm sure you could tell from our conversation, I could spend a lot more time thinking about it and becoming more involved in the kind of activism. And through that, hopefully, you know, sort of, again, like wrestling with my own, you know, it just real quick, I'll say, because I sort of intimated that that was an issue for me, is that, you know, there was a period of time when I was living in San Francisco, I live in LA now, when I did consider myself very sex positive. I loved watching porn. I just didn't care or really bother thinking. It was very easy for me to just go, I don't care. These are people having sex. I don't really care what the backstory is. This is hot. Mm-hmm. And then something happened where all of a sudden I became incredibly worried about the women. And I can't even really say when that was, you know. And so then it became like, well, what is there? Okay, hentai. Well, listen, that's just animation. Nobody's getting hurt there. Let's like, how do you, you know, and then it's sort of, okay, HBO is doing some really extraordinary work in terms of making all of those wonderful gray areas, gray being a good thing, that you were talking about before, which is, listen, it's not just this and it's not just this. What about all of these thousands of subcultures and websites where it's just two people in love who want to have sex in front of a camera, and, you know, all of these different ways of kind of bringing that stuff out in the open? And I think often, and I'd love to hear what you think, in a very playful, very non-threatening way, that is available, you know, that's about as public and as kind of cross-section of humanity as you can get if you're mm-hmm. lucky enough to have access to HBO, which of course is a pay channel,
right?
Class. But that to me is one of the best places to go to find out about this stuff in a way that feels inclusive rather than like, oh, mm-hmm. ooh, we're all pointing our fingers at this crazy kink, you know.
Right. Well, I think what is important, I like that. I think gray is a good thing. You know, I think that should be like a tagline, because like, I've had the same experience. So even with my like, vast array of experiences and like all the thought I've put into this, it's like, I watch porn and occasionally I'll watch porn and be like, oh, I hope everybody's okay in this, you know,
exactly.
And I can find myself creating assumptions, and I'm usually thinking about something a little different, like how much are they getting paid, you know,
sure.
Like did anybody tell them about what they should do or not do, like are they being told that they won't make as much money if they don't use a condom, things like that,
sure.
You know, and I think it comes down to you know, do people know what their rights are? Do people feel like they have the leeway to negotiate their own actions and experience? I myself have worked in a variety of fetish and BDSM porn, and I've had amazing experiences on some sets where I feel like I was just in such good care and that all of my limits were totally respected. And then I've worked on some where it's like, okay, and we're rolling and we've done this a ton today, and you know, this is a quantity over quality, and so much bad shit can happen on set when you have that kind of attitude, you know.
Yeah.
I think a lot of bad shit can happen when you go quality over quantity in general, when it talks to like, you know, when you're talking about like the human capacity involved in making that quantity.
Yeah.
And that certainly definitely goes for things like porn. So I have some friends who have had some awful experiences in porn. And I feel like I think a lot of that is from stigma, you know. I think a lot of that comes from like kind of like a lack of labor rights, perhaps. I feel like I'm not enough of authority on working in the main street adult industry to talk about that. If you're ever interested in the future, I could probably hook you up with somebody. But yeah, but I think gray is a good thing. And oh, so one thing that I want to leave with the audience and with you is this idea of ethical consumerism, you know. There's no reason why we can't be ethical consumers of services that people provide to the world and to us directly.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I became aware of ethical consumerism in middle school when I heard about sweatshops, you know, and that really opened my mind and I started paying attention to what I was wearing.
Yeah.
Now when I'm at a restaurant or at a coffee shop, you know, if it seems like the workers are overworked or just having like a really fucking shitty time across the board consistently, I might question whether that's like, a great establishment, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of how they treat their workers. If I watch porn and it seems like participants are kind of like out of it, or if the set's really dirty, or if, you know, if people are checked out, you know, it's like you can kind of question whether certain studios are being careful mm-hmm. and ethical and mindful of their performers' wellness. And those are questions you can ask. And as a consumer, you can kind of vote with your consumption of these various products, you know.
That's great. That's a great reminder.
Yeah.
That's a great reminder.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's get into the MASH game. So here is my MASH game, MASH categories for you. Number one is, and I just need you to list three per category, because then I'll do some fancy footwork at the end and tell you what your 100% guaranteed MASH future is.
I'm so excited.
Okay, first one is, you wake up tomorrow morning and you have downloaded, sort of magically Matrix style, three skills.
And what would those three skills be?
And you can go as superhero-y as you want, but you could also go as, like, I really wish I knew how to use QuickBooks better, which is probably what I would say.
I do wish I knew how to. Okay, I'm going to go with that, actually. I'm going to go with QuickBooks for nonprofits, because I just downloaded that for Swap USA, and the bookkeeper and I are going to try and tackle it, but holy shit.
Amazing. Like, amazing. I read your mind.
Yeah, you sure? You did, because you downloaded mind reading.
Okay, cool. And then two more.
I think that I would love to download all of the social and political suave that a person can possess. I feel like just being able to navigate, like, all situations with people that requires communication and talking. Yeah. Like, I want to be like a super communicator. And
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love it.
Impervious to good days and bad days.
Oh, God, that would really be great.
And three, I guess this is getting back to, like, you know, 7-year-old me, but I wish I could turn into any animal at whim. I want to be a shapeshifter.
Oh, my God, I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. This is the most fun, varied series of skills that I think I've ever gotten. This is perfect.
Well, okay.
Well played, well played. And then this next one will be three places that it would be fun to have a vacation home here on planet Earth if it wasn't like a huge headache to get there. I don't want you to add, you know, factor that in. If it's an island in the middle of nowhere, let's pretend you can just teleport there.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm not the kind of person who has, like, a favorite place. I don't have a long list of, like, travel destinations. Assuming that an earthquake doesn't rip the open earth and swallow the Emerald City whole, like, Seattle is by far and away my favorite city in North America, and it would be really great to have a solid, awesome, big, expansive crash pad there whenever I wanted. Where else? Probably somewhere on a magic mountain. Could be kind of anywhere, but somewhere off the grid and completely independent in a gorgeous environment, sort of far and away from it all.
Love it.
Where I could turn the internet on or off if I wished.
Yeah,
and there'd be like a nice quarry of rocks and a body of water I could swim in, and trails, and I could be
this
as loud as I
also
wanted.
Also, my total fantasy. We need to get this going immediately.
Let's get
we need
it
to become like
going.
James Bond supervillain, so that we have like a helipad. That
yeah,
we can
I want like a progressive pagan bat cave that's not in a cave. You know, there can be
love
caves.
Couldn't agree more.
And then where else? I don't know. Like, I think that my ultimate vacation home could just be in any town where I felt like there was a really cool, funky bar and like an arts community and a cool cafe where I could go and hang out all day and do some typing. And some, I love to run on woods trails. So anywhere where there's like a park or some forests and some hills. And I travel a lot. And so whenever I travel, I always try and find those neighborhoods. And, you know, I can be kind of happy anywhere as long as I have those kinds of basic things. So that kind of vacation home could kind of be anywhere, I guess, you know?
If I can God, get, like, I love it.
Yeah.
Everything you're saying is all stuff I gravitate towards. Like, I was just going to say, there's, in many ways, you just described Flagstaff, which is where I went to school for my first
year. Oh, really? Is Flagstaff? I'm always so surprised, too, like, when I find those places. Like, I was in Amarillo, Texas, this April, just driving through, and, like, it was looking pretty bleak, but, like, I'm the kind of person, I'll spend, like, 3 hours researching where the perfect bar or coffee shop is, and then I will find it, and that's usually when I find, like, the strip or the neighborhood that I want to hang out in, you know? So Flagstaff, good to know.
Oh, yeah, I think you would love it. I think you would absolutely love it. Couldn't be more confident about that. Okay, great. Love these. Okay. Then one of my perennial favorites, three foods that are in this alternate universe actually good for you rather than for whatever reason you can't have them in excess in this particular world that we live in. In our MASH world, you can eat chocolate chip cookies and sustain vitamins from them.
Oh, my goodness.
That kind of thing.
I love this world.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
You know, I feel like I'm about to admit something really big on air. Okay. And some of my friends, if any of my friends listen to this, they might be like, oh, really? And, I really, really like mayonnaise. And, in a perfect world, mayonnaise wouldn't clog my arteries. It also wouldn't be such a stigmatized, gross, milky, coagulative substance, you know?
God, this is exactly what this MASH game is for. It's for
okay, that
like
felt...
I'm very proud of you.
Felt pretty intimate.
I'm very proud of you. I guarantee you are not alone.
Yeah, a big one. In a perfect world, eating animals wouldn't have such a huge fucked up impact on our world. So eating meat and fish, I feel so bad whenever I eat fish or meat now because it's like fuck talking about almonds using so much water. It's like, how come we're not talking about like beef ranches and stuff like that?
Yep.
And then the pollution of the ocean, it just totally dejects me. So in my world, I could eat all the fish I wanted and just be like, there would just be like more of them. Just like jump. And also, you know, if it didn't like harm them too, that would be really great, you know?
I think that's another great one.
I take that over mayonnaise actually. And then another one, caffeine. I really like coffee. I like mate. I'm kind of like, you know, like I like speedy things and, I like that jolt of coffee in the morning, but it is extremely acidic. And, I don't really drink too much coffee very often, you know, but if I'm traveling a lot, if I'm sick or stressed, like coffee, I can definitely feel it kind of wearing on my body. And, I guess that goes for like alcohol too. all those acidic, astringent things.
Absolutely.
But yeah, really but
yeah, that's
animals first.
That's a great one.
Animals first.
Animals first. We got three great ones. Three movies that you can jump into and the worlds are real. So it's not like you're an actor in the movie. It's like this imaginary cinematic world is a place that you can kind of escape into and hang out with the characters and be in that land.
Dinotopia, definitely. This is going to sound like a gnarly one, but Sin City was highly influential on me. So I was like, when I'm talking about like those comic books I would sneak a glimpse of when I was younger, I actually got my hands on a fucking copy of Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. And that was like the hottest, most provocative, most compelling shit I read in my, you know, 9-year-old existence. And when the movies came out, I was just so thrilled. So I would love to go into Sin City and hang out in Old Town with all oh man, those are like my people right there. So, I love Sin City because it's all these guys getting killed in the name of sex workers, you know, like it's like, baby, I'm gonna go out there on a limb for you and I'm gonna get that guy, you know, or I'm gonna avenge her death, you know, like I just love that.
Absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
And then there's some fucked up shit with sex workers too, but you know, we're used to that. That's the norm.
Right.
In media, you know.
You take the bad with the good. Yeah.
A third movie. I don't watch a lot of movies. Movies. What have I seen? What do I wanna watch?
Or something from when you're a kid, I guess. Yeah.
Yellow Submarine, so that I could go and live in Pepperland.
Absolutely, that's a great one.
And actually, when I'm at Gasworks Park in Seattle and sitting on top of the hill and looking out at the city, I'm like, Pepperland. You know, it's just very much like that. So,
absolutely. Okay, and then this one is this is like if you had time to have a sort of other career, and I use this one a lot, and it can also be kind of. It doesn't have to be career like a lawyer. It could be like, oh, I have a cafe, you know, or oh, I opened up this dog park or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think about this a lot, and I think a lot of sex workers think about this a lot. Before I really dove into sex work, and all along, I've been a performing artist, and I think that I would love to have that take a stab of that as a as a career, which might involve writing and you know, kind of all that stuff. So that's one, assuming I could scrape out a living. It's awfully challenging. I kind of have a fantasy of opening a really funky tea house somewhere, maybe in that that town that where I have my vocation. Well, up on the Magic Mountain, that would be good, but I'd want more people to come to it. I would want to have this oasis of eclectic excellence in the middle of, like, Amarillo, Texas or something. So I think about things like that, you know, a little performance venue and tea and food and all that. And I don't know. Well, I'm putting all this free, uncompensated time into Swap USA, and I'm kind of navigating, you know, nonprofit structures, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm kind of just throwing myself into it. And it has me wondering, like, am I kind of cut out for this? You know, like, would I like to pursue some sort of occupation in the nonprofit sector, working for human rights? So I don't know. I have a, I have a 2-year obligation with Swap, and after that, we'll see what happens.
Love it. Love, love, love. Okay. Next one is, this is pretty specific, so hopefully it will spark some ideas for you. If I had to apply it to myself right now, I don't know if I'd come up with much, except for maybe Anne of Green Gables. But three book characters that are like your best friend and or mentor, or, you know, sort of the, a person that comes into real life that can give you advice or just have, that you can just have fun and play with.
Talking about childhood, I would probably say Martin of Redwall from the Redwall series. I don't know if anybody is familiar with that, but it's a fantasy series about animals who live in medieval times. And as I want to be a shapeshifter with my super download power, you know, like, I'm really into animal people. So if Martin the Warrior could come to life as a mouse and talk to me, that would be really great.
That's great. Good luck topping that.
Yeah. Two more. Let's see. Well, I've been reading a book by this guy named Jack Schwartz, who was this, like, kind of, for back of a letter term, better term, super yogi, like, really connected to his body through meditation. And he was involved in MIT with all these weird experiments where they would, like, skewer his bicep and he would heal it with his mind 30 minutes later, you know? He passed away. He dissolved, and he is floating around the ether now with David Bowie and has been for years. But if he could manifest again and come out of his book and hang out with me, I'm sure I'd have some questions for him. He's not fictional. But
love it.
And let's see, there's got to be another amazing fictional character. I'm trying to think of the books. This is one of my issues. It's kind of like movies. I can't remember all the books I've read. I've got a whole bunch of books on my shelf.
This is a lot of pressure for anybody, including, like, my friends who are improvisers, are like, this is the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
Oh, well, I'm really enjoying it, you know? Like, I'm just trying to, like, I guess the book thing is hard, so I'm like, I feel like, I don't know what books I've read. I feel a little dumb, but I know I've read a buttload of books.
Well, you know what? It could even be Sin City. What about a Sin City character?
I was just thinking, you know, it's like, yeah, definitely in Sin City, I could go and hang out with any of the chicks in Old Town. But I've already talked about them. I think any of the ladies from X-Men, you know?
Oh, great.
Yeah, especially probably great Mystique character. Because she is the kind of shapeshifter that I want to be, and I think she's really sexy. And if she wanted to, like, maybe go on a cocktail date with me, that'd be really cool.
I love it. That is that will bleed into the next category, which is person, character, thing, creature, whatever, that it would be fun to either have as a alternate universe spouse or a one-nighter or any varying degree in between of sexy love times.
I would love to be able to experience what it's like to be different people on this earth. And there's a variety of different people on this earth who I think their experiences are underrepresented or underhood or misunderstood. And to be able to step into that person's shoes and skin literally so you could experience the way that they experience life would be tremendous, you know. So somebody who has, like, a burning desire to be a different gender, you know, and they really feel misgendered, you know, or somebody who has you know, somebody who has like different skin color. I would love to have like an actual penis and more testosterone to feel what that's like, you know?
Sure.
So the ability to turn into different human beings on this earth and experience how they experience life would be excellent and really interesting.
That is a way that, no, I've never heard anyone use this category, and I'm very impressed. Usually yeah. someone's just like, I'd like to have sex with Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
Which you can also do.
Yeah. No, I feel, I mean, I don't doubt that Angelina's life is fascinating, but when it comes to the top three ever, you know,
yeah,
I think that I would love to, you know, I'd love to be an extraterrestrial being, you know, like that would be really excellent to know what other parts of space are like to live in or what it's like to exist as a different non-Earth planetary life form or gaseous right. being or whatever you might be. You know, I want to be a vapor cloud in the ether.
I love it.
And then what else? I don't know. This just popped to mind. This is totally just like riffing, but you know, a dragon, you know, like the ability to breathe fire. That sounds pretty cool, you know, like, I feel like I spend a lot of time in my yoga practice trying to develop inner fire, you know, to like warm myself, you know, and to actually just have a fire existing within you that you can like incinerate people with if they piss you off, you know, like, and being able to fly and all that jazz and
sure.
You know,
Hell yeah.
Dragon.
That's great. Okay. And then final got dragon in there. Awesome. And then the last one is, I like this one. This is sort of, I thought because you like, you were saying that you enjoy kind of fantasy roles and stuff like that, and you probably get to explore this a lot in your work anyway, but are there different styles from history that for one reason or another you probably won't like go down to the tea house wearing for either comfort or that you probably would, you know, that you would want to be more anonymous than the stares that you would elicit? I'll list like, oh, I wish I could, you know, I really enjoy like jodhpurs and riding boots. And I sort of find myself trying to like do that on a regular basis. Yeah. I find my, like, what is my version of that in this world? But if I could just prance around in like a vest and a waistcoat, like that has tails and, you know, if I looked like a, like a 1700s British soldier, I probably wouldn't mind that so much. Mm-hmm. So is there anything like that that would be really fun to get to kind of see yourself in, with no holds barred?
Well, this is interesting. It's sort of like asking people, like, if you could be born at any point in time, when would it be? And I keep coming to, like, I was born at exactly the right time because I exist, you know, on the cusp of communication technology and all this. But I live in the era of fucking yoga pants, Janet, you know, and yoga pants you know, compression clothing.
Right now.
Me too. And they're so good. And I feel like so professional in them, you know, put a slap of blazer on it. And but we're not talking now, we're talking in the past. So I guess I'll start with, I would love to wear, even finer compression, full body suits from the future, you know,
nice,
kind of like you see in all those movies like Tron and stuff. I would love to wear a Tron. I'm
agreed.
Big on to the spandex.
You have named my favorite movie, so I'm very on board for this.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
So I want a Tron suit. I love, I'm pretty genderqueer. It's taken me a while to be able to like say that out loud, because I feel like I'm taking somebody else's descriptor, because gender's never been a conflict for me. But I love my masculine energy, and I love dressing like a dapper man in slacks and a little vest and a little jacket with a newsy cap. I look really good in a newsy cap with a mustache.
I'm telling you, that is a great look for women.
It really is.
Drag or otherwise.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, I love it. And then I kind of get all saucy and I want to like hit on the ladies, you know, but I'm kind of shy because I'm sort of a nice guy too. There's this whole side of me that comes out when I dress like that.
I absolutely love it.
And then for a third one, this isn't really a different time so much as a different culture, but I've come into the possession of two really beautiful silk kimonos, and then I recently bought one from this wonderful store. It's cotton, but from in Seattle, and I really, really enjoy wearing them. And those are ones that, like, I'm so much more comfortable wearing the cat suit in public or the dapper gentleman suit, you know? Like, so when I wear a kimono, I feel like, A, this isn't quite my culture and I'm not sure what this means, you know, like, but I think this is the
I
most.
I feel the same way. I worry. I go down that road too, because I think, I mean, quite honestly, and I'm sure that there is something innately racist about this, and I don't mean it to be, but if I could wear a beautiful Indian Chiefs headdress,
mm-hmm.
I mean, oh, it's beautiful,
yeah.
Or mm-hmm. a beautiful beaded, you know, some of this beaded stuff that's from the tribes of the state that I grew up in, or some of the stuff that gets made. There are these amazing feathered coats that communities in New Zealand make, and it's like, I'm not going to prance around in one of those. I don't feel like that's my right, but
right.
In an alternate universe where there's no political implication whatsoever, and it is purely an admiration of style and craftsmanship, mm-hmm. in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I feel the same way about
that. Makes perfect sense.
About yep, I feel the same way about head wraps and different kinds of turbans. Which I really only feel like I have permission to wear those things in places like Burning Man, you know, like where everything's right. just sort of like a giant culture blend.
It's
in
up
some
for
ways.
Grabs. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's great.
But
that's
I do
great.
Shy away from wearing these gorgeous kimonos, and I really want to figure out how to incorporate them into my life because they're just collecting dust right now. And
you will not be surprised to hear that I have 4 vintage kimonos, 2 of which I got in Japan, 2 of which
yeah.
I got in Japantown here in San Francisco. Same exact thing. Like, okay, am I having a dinner party where everyone who knows me well enough will not look at me in any way askance, and they'll just understand that it's a beautiful robe, or you know what I mean?
So what we need to do, Janet, is we need to have a dinner party with really ethically harvested fish on our magic mountain wearing our kimonos.
I love it.
And we'll invite everybody from the tea house.
It.
Okay.
And then we'll tie our kimono up into a little bow and go trail running.
Exactly. Yeah. On the lush mossy trails of the magic mountain. It'll
Amazing.
Be low impact on our knees.
Amazing. Okay, here's what we're gonna do. You tell me, just tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay. Let's see. I'm going to try to weave this into some sort of interesting, there's a lot of stuff that kind of did create, there is some stuff that really flows together very, very nicely. I'm just going to jump right into it. So I want to congratulate you. Now, listen, Mansion Apartment Shack House, I have to tell you that you did get a shack, but
I got a shack.
But listen, here's
did I get a shack on the Magic Mountain? You know, I'm okay with that.
Yes, you did. You got a shack on the Magic Mountain.
That's all I want. That's okay.
I know. I really felt very good about that.
It's
I thought
better
listen,
that
if
way.
If there's a person who is going to enjoy that, besides, to be honest with you, I don't know. It could be that it leads into some kind of crazy invisible lair. That
I definitely
just looks like a shack.
Don't want a mansion. I think having a mansion would make me a little uncomfortable. Actually, I'm happy to
feel
visit
the
them.
Same way.
Too big.
The same way.
Too big.
I don't like feeling lost inside a place. I just. I'm sure the 2-bedroom house that I live in would seem too big to someone, but probably not that many people. It's pretty much exactly the size I need. So, when I'm in some place that feels really opulent, I just feel like I'm being swallowed up by it. So congratulations on your wonderful shack, on your magic mountain.
So pleased.
By the way, you're also spending plenty of time in your beautiful tea house on said mountain. So that's
fabulous.
Like a whole other building. You are wearing your beautiful kimono
yes!
in the tea house.
I'm really liking how this is shaping up.
And then this all flows together perfectly. Well, I'm just going to throw this side thing in, which is that you can disappear into the movie Dinotopia. But it's actually not a side thing because you can shapeshift into a dragon.
Yes.
Because you're a shapeshifter.
Yes.
And your best friend is Mystique. So it's just a couple of hot shapeshifters.
We're just shapeshifting.
The world.
Now, how would that be for a porn scene between two like fairly treated, consenting adult performers?
Incredibly.
Oh, my God.
And then I want you to know that all of the shapeshifting and sexual adventurousness is maybe going to be exhausting. I want you to rest assured you can have as much caffeine as you want to stay perky.
Sweet.
Because that is what you got.
And it's not going to eat up my insides.
It's not going to eat up your insides. No acid in sight. No acid in sight.
Yeah.
Savannah, that is a glorious mash. I'm very impressed at the results, and certainly they wouldn't have been possible without your very, very smart on the go thinking that just on the spur of the moment you came up with some great stuff.
It feels like a sparkling magical reality that could be mine in many senses. You know, I feel like some of that, like I can
agree.
Wear a kimono on a mountain in a little shack and have my tea house, and you know, maybe if I meditate enough, I can turn into a dragon someday, and maybe Mystique will come, you know, out of the woods, and you know, all will be revealed that, you know, reality is more than we think it is. So
I love it so much. I would take all of those things right alongside you. So great work. Now tell me where people can find more, because again, I'm 100% sure that people are going to be pleased yet not sated by this episode. So where can they go?
Well, they can go and find me at Twitter. That's the easiest place to find me, and that's where I'm most active. And so that's just at Savannah Sly.
Great, at Savannah Sly, great.
They can go to swapusa.org to see what I'm working on and what I'm putting all my time towards with about 100 other activists at any given time. I have a totally, it's not a lifeless blog. There's a ton of great stuff on there. I have all these intentions of writing more to it, but you can find that. You can go to my professional website, MsSavannah.com, and find all about
great.
But I'm not working much these days. Or if somebody has burning questions and they want to talk to me about any variety of things, they can hire me to talk to them on Skype or on Nightflirt. We can do the sex worker thing. It'd be really fun. And then depending
That's fantastic.
Yeah, support my activism, talk to me on Skype and throw me $20 every 10 minutes. That's how it works, I'll do it topless.
I think that's outstanding. Guys, perk up. And by guys, I call all of you guys girls and guys, and I mean it in the most loving way.
That everybody.
I've been doing from the beginning.
Everybody.
Savannah, thank you so much. I'm so pleased with this. I'm so thrilled we were able to do this. I was my initial feeling of oh no, she's not anywhere near me turned out to be unjustified, because we just had as intimate of a conversation as we would have had in person. So I'm
totally
delighted.
Yeah.
Thank you. Guys, I will talk to you next time on the podcast. As always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.